This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Everywhere you looked this past spring, you saw stories about the preordained hot vac summer and slutty summer that was about to erupt in America like a long simmering volcano of carnal desire. Real and imagined experts predicted that single people, newly vaxxed and after a long involuntary sexual pause due to COVID lockdowns, would be on the prowl like some mix of the premenopausal Sex and the City girls, inmates freed after 18 months in solitary confinement, and the randy castaways of Love Island. I regret to inform you that Hot Vax Summer, like so many action films released in June, July, and August, just didn't live up to the hype. While some observers say the reasons for slutty summer going softer than Liberace at a Speculum conference include the Delta variant and the rise of online porn, my guest today says it's simply because there's been a long, slow decline in one-night stands and hookup culture for years. She's Dr. Helen Fisher, an anthropologist who is the chief science advisor to Match.com, a senior research fellow at the Kinsey Institute, and the author of, most recently, Anatomy of Love. For each of the past 11 years, she's overseen Singles in America, an annual survey of more than 5,000 singles of every age, gender, and sexual orientation. Across the board, but especially among millennials and Gen Z, she says that looks are out, emotional maturity is in, and that stability is the new sexy. There are lots of reasons for this, but she cites younger people's interests in self-care as driving the changes, along with ever-rising options for women in education and work. As women's status, earnings, and opportunities have risen, says Fisher, they've become pickier about partners. Men, too, have changed and are now more likely to say they want a long-term partner than women are. They also want a partner who is well-educated, successful, and financially stable, following the so-called George Clooney effect. This new parity is reflected in one of the survey's most remarkable findings. An equal number of men and women say they faked orgasms in the past year. In today's episode, I talk with Helen Fisher about the turn to what she calls slow love in an age of dating apps, the relief most men feel at not having to be the sole breadwinner, and why the rise of growing sexual opportunities is libertarian but not libertine. But before we get to today's Reason interview, I want to take a moment to introduce today's advertiser, Inkle.com. If you're like me, keeping up with the news has become a real pain. All the best news sites are locked behind paywalls, and the free stuff is just clickbait and fake news that nobody should waste time on. So imagine an app where you can get unlocked access to the reliable news sites. An app that filters out fake news and clickbait, but still shows you every story from multiple perspectives to counter bias. Where good news, and by that I mean positive stories, are highlighted so you don't become despondent, and where journalists dig through the news from around the world to find stories you wouldn't normally see. That's what an innovative Australian startup called Inkle, I-N-K-L, has come up with. Inkle.com has signed partnerships with over 100 news sources like The Economist, The Atlantic, and Bloomberg, and they've created a unique system combining journalists and algorithms to create a best-of-news feed. The service unlocks more than $12,000 of premium news for $100 a year. And if you go to inkle.com/reason, they're going to give you an additional 25% discount, so you can get a whole year's worth of headache-free news for just $75. That's inkle.com/reason, inkl.com/reason. And now, here's the Reason interview with Dr. Helen Fisher talking about the not-so-slutty summer of 2021. Dr. Helen Fisher, thanks for talking to Reason.
I'm delighted to talk to you, Nick.
All right. So you are the chief science advisor for Match.com. You're a senior research fellow at the Kinsey Institute. You're the author most recently of An Anatomy of Love, or Anatomy of Love, the second edition from 2016. And you've just released with Match, Singles in America, the 11th edition of a national representative poll of people who call themselves single, not Match.com users. It's everybody, all ages, all genders, all orientations, all colors, all flavors. And the top line result really was kind of, and I'm summarizing here, that the wet, hot, slutty summer of 2021 was a bust. Everybody was talking about how, like, you know, when you open the gates on the pandemic, people are going to be, you know, shtupping like rabbits. It didn't happen. Is that a correct assessment?
Absolutely. I mean, actually, I call it post-traumatic growth. Singles have really just simply grown up. But, people have been asking me all along about the slutty summer and whether this was going to happen. They were anticipating it. And it didn't surprise me that it wasn't. I mean, you know, actually 45% of these singles said that the ideal sexual relationship for them would be in a committed partnership. But what's interesting is these singles, more singles got vaxxed. 73% of singles in America got vaxxed as opposed to 64% of the general population. And they are picky. And in fact, I think the reason they got vaxxed more than the general population is because they're advertising that they are healthy, and they're also advertising.
So this is kind, I mean, you can't advertise that you're HIV free or, you know, that you don't have chlamydia anymore or something like that. Right. But you can kind of be like, hey, you know what? I'm taking care of myself.
But they're taking care of their community, too. They're advertising I'm not only safe and healthy, but I'm listening to the rules. I'm following the rules. I'm respecting authority. And I'm saying that I'm helping with herd immunity.
Yeah.
You've
said, that's my neighborhood in New York versus yours. I have a lot of car horns here. The current zeitgeist has it wrong. Looks are out. Emotional maturity is in. Stability is the new sexy.
Right.
You know, there's a lot to unpack there. And first, the current zeitgeist. I mean, the media, I think, probably always, and public health people, they always assume everybody everywhere is having sex, you know, unsafe sex and dirty sex and all of this. That's kind of been, you know, wrong for many years, right? But then you say looks are out and emotional maturity is in. Is that across the board? Because you look at Gen Z, as well as, you know, millennials, Gen X, baby boomers, I guess not too many of the silent generation are left, but, is that stable? Like, are we actually entering a phase where, you know, for the first time, finally, personality counts, not, right, you know, what you look like?
Well, I think personality has always counted. Yeah. But what's interesting now is that it counts more. I want to go back to the slutty summer for one thing. Mm-hmm. You know,
because So do I.
Because all of these people are now vaxxed. You know, we found in the Singles in America study that 58% of singles will not have sex with somebody who's not vaxxed. 54% will not even start a romance with somebody who's not vaxxed. And 52% won't even go out on a first date with somebody who's not vaxxed. And in fact, 48% of singles believe that if you're not vaxxed, you're selfish. So no wonder there was no slutty summer. I mean, if you're not going to even go out on a first date with somebody or kiss or hug them, I mean, you're certainly not going to have a slutty summer. But one thing that's interesting about that, you know, people assume that just because the gates are open, as you say, that was like very nice and vivid, people are going to go out and,
you know, it's like the running of the bulls, right?
But you know what? That's not the way the brain works. I mean, I studied the brain, and you know, there's a bar on every single corner in New York City. Not everybody's an alcoholic. I mean, just because things are available, people don't change who they are. And what this pandemic did was it just made all these singles grow up. They are really, as you were just saying, they're now looking for something stable. I mean, yes, looks still count, but not the way they did count.
Yeah. And elsewhere, you've said that, you know, bad boys and, you know, and kind of crazy girls are out.
Yes.
Is this only over the past couple of years of pandemic, or is this part of a longer term trend to you were calling it post-traumatic growth?
Yes.
But so can you talk a little bit about that? And then is that really over the past couple of years, or is this a longer lived phenomenon?
Yeah. The trend is longer, but there was a huge leap forward since the pandemic. I mean, you know, I've mentioned to you before about this concept of slow love and the fact that singles are, you know, in my day, people married in their early 20s. Now they're married in their late 20s or early 30s.
Yeah. And you've written that it used to be that marriage was the beginning of a relationship, you know, 100 years ago. And now it is really the culmination of a commitment. Yeah, it's the finale.
But what's happened now is during this pandemic, singles really had a good deal of time to sit in their bedroom and wonder what they're doing. And they're noticing what they have, and they've noticed what they don't have. And so we compared in this most recent Singles in America study, people's attitudes right now, which we collected the data this summer, which is very recent, as opposed to 2019, which is right before the pandemic hit. And I think of all of the most telling pieces of data was the question. I create about 200 questions every year. And then we go out, we poll all these singles, and then we assemble all the data to see what's going on. And the single most important question for me, as it turned out, I didn't know it at the time, was, you know, do you want to have a partner who wants to get married? Mm-hmm. And
is it get married or is it be in a committed relationship?
Get married.
Really?
Yeah. Get married. And in 2019, 58% of singles said yes, they'd like to have a partner who wants to get married. And in 2021, 76% of singles said yes, they wanted a partner who wanted to get married.
Do you think that'll hold up, you know, as things kind of, I mean, they're not normalizing, but as eventually when they do normalize, or is it kind of like, you know, people are in a long dark night of the soul, and it's like, yeah, I want to lock something down because the pandemic might come back.
You know, Nick, it is really, I think, the number one question. I don't know the answer, but I think the courtship stage will remain very long. I think people will continue to be marrying. Now, this is my hypothesis. You might have the same or different. I think they will still be marrying later. That, you know, particularly millennials. I'm crazy about millennials. These people are serious. They're getting to know who they are. They're putting their career together. They're figuring out how to deal with their money. So I think that they will continue to have a long courtship process. But I think that they will start looking for somebody sooner. I don't think they're going to marry any sooner, but I think they're going to start looking for a partner sooner. And all of my data show, and I've looked since 1940s around the world, I've got data on 80 cultures. The longer you court and the later you marry, the more likely you are to stay together.
You know,
and
when I read that,
I will continue.
Yeah, when I read that, I'm reminded of, you know, so I was born in 63. So I think we're both in the baby boom. Is that correct? Mm-hmm. Or thereabouts?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I'm at the tail end.
I'm a lot older than you are.
Well, you know, but you look a lot younger. So we're kind of on the same page, right?
It's very good.
But I remember reading Ann Landers, and this would have been in the 70s, maybe when I was in high school. And, you know, she would have that. You know, and for people who don't know who Ann Landers was, she was the foremost advice column in America for, you know, 1,000 years. I think she was here when the Pilgrims landed at Plymouth Rock. Ann Landers was there giving them her first column. But she had a quiz, you know, where like you would do bad behavior, which could include kissing while lying down and things like that. But one of her findings, she always said, was that long engagements lead to failed marriages. But what you're saying is that Ann Landers had it wrong, that, you know, that it's...
Nick, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. I guess in those days, they were trying to decide what to do. These days, they're putting themselves together. And but these days, you know, more people have gone to college. There's many more women in the workforce who have spent a lot of time sort of just... putting themselves together, getting a good job. Singles today and millennials and men are leading the way. During this pandemic, we asked almost 70% of millennials, now these are the young, said they worked on their career, that they're better at handling their money, and that they're better at handling their time. They're getting more sleep. They're gaining self-confidence. During this pandemic, they gain self-confidence.
How does that square with the image? You know, there's a broad narrative, cultural narrative, and it's changed a couple times with the millennials, and it will continue to, as, I mean, they're the single largest cohort. They're displacing the baby boom. And then Gen Z is also pretty big right behind them. But, you know, we've heard that millennials are lazy, that they're selfish, that they're slackers, they're self-obsessed. I mean, it seems like, I mean, you're painting a different picture based on the single millennials and what they've been up to the past couple of years.
All I can say is that, we now have data on 55,000 singles. It is a representative sample and, it's real data. And I think that, listen, there's a million myths. We don't understand who men are. We don't understand who women are. We don't understand much about sex. It's unbelievable how far we need to go still. But the bottom line is, you know, for example, one third of millennials before the pandemic lived at home. Well, people say, well, they're lazy. No, they were saving their money. They were putting their lives together, you know, and singles, the millennials today, I mean, I'm calling them the new Victorians. I mean, they really are, they have much less sex than we did in my generation. They're careful. And they've
They're having less sex than you're having right now. Isn't that true, Dr. Helen Fisher?
I got married, kid. Yeah. So okay.
Can we talk about we'll get to millennials in a second, because I want to ask, why are they having less sex? But first, can you kind of paint, you know, if we date the sexual revolution to, I don't know, you know, maybe the 60s, certainly the sexual revolution came fully online in the 1970s. And if I'm recalling data from various surveys, like monitoring the future and whatnot, basically sex, drugs, and, you know, for lack of a better term, rock and roll, you know, peaked in the late 70s for younger, people in their 20s and high school seniors. Since then, it's been a pretty steady decline in the number of people who leave high school having had sex, the number of people who leave college. I mean, it's
absolutely.
What can you, before we get to millennials right now, but like what explains that diminution in sexual activity at the precise moment when I think America as a culture threw off its Victorian cloak and it threw off, you know, this, you know, primness, and puritanical nature that it's always been lampooned for. You know, in the 90s, I mean, you couldn't turn on the nightly news without hearing about oral sex and, you know, other kind of sexual activities in the White House. And yet people were having less sex than ever.
You know, this is a question that a lot of scientists have tried to answer. And among the things that they end up saying is, well, a lot of these people are very busy. You know, they've got a lot of extracurricular activities. A lot of these people grew up in what in the old days they called a broken home, and they see the fragility of relationships. A lot of them are spending an awful lot of time having second jobs and getting through college and then paying off college debt and building a career. It's a very serious generation, Nick. And
millennials. I mean, can I ask? Because I've talked about this with a number of people, and then when the police come, you know, I leave when they tell me that, you know. But some people have hypothesized though that also the rise of various kinds of depression medications, SSRIs, and things like that. And it's true, the younger you are, the more likely you are to be on one of these drugs, which tend to depress sexual.
No question about it. You're driving yes, and in fact, that's the thank you. Because that's generally something that I say, and I forgot. Yes, you know, murder is down,
right?
And depression and suicide is up.
So you're saying if we had more murders, we would be happier. That's what I'm hearing.
Well, I wouldn't have said that. Yeah. But the bottom line is, a lot of these people are taking drugs, and I frankly, somebody's going to kill me for this, but sometimes I'm beginning to wonder whether it's fashionable to feel a little bit mentally ill. And
that is curious, isn't it? I mean, you're an anthropologist by training, an academic anthropologist, but you write widely on a variety of things and obviously psychosexual topics. But isn't that like I can remember there was a period when I was growing up in the 70s where it was fashionable to have allergies, to go to the allergies.
Oh, really?
You know, that was kind of cool because it's like you get a shot and this and that. But now millennials and Gen Z talk about mental health all of the time. There was a recent study from the New America Foundation that found more millennials and Gen Z people reported last year that they couldn't do their daily tasks because of physical problems. They had higher percentages saying that than baby boomers who are now in their late 50s and onward.
Yeah.
What's going on with that?
Well, I mean, certainly, I think that, you know, simply taking all of those drugs, Lexapro, the older ones, Prozac, all of them, they drive up the serotonin system in the brain. And it's very clear that as you drive up the serotonin system, you're driving down the testosterone and particularly the dopamine system, which are linked with sexuality. There's no question about that.
And I realize this is, you know, very promiscuous kind of theorizing, but, you know, one of the takeaways in the Singles in America, the 11th year study put out by Match of single people in America, is that men are nesting more, men are looking for commitment, men are acting in ways that are traditionally associated with female behavior, right? And female likes. I mean, is it the drugs?
Far from it. Okay. It's a total misconception about what a man is.
Right.
You know, men are, every single year, we've done this for 11 years, men, every single year, men fall in love faster than women. They fall in love more often than women. When they meet a woman that they are in love with, they want to introduce that person to friends and family sooner. As an ethologist,
so you're saying men are emotionally childlike, right?
No, I would say that men are more emotionally fragile.
Yeah.
And men want to move in sooner. Men want to, men have more intimate conversations with their partners than women do, because women have their very intimate conversations with their girlfriends. And this is not match data, but general psychology data, psychological data. Men are 2.5 times more likely to kill themselves when a relationship is over. I mean, women seem to be the custodian of the relationship.
Is that, you know, is that an evolutionary thing? Obviously, it's got any evolutionary, you know, kind of, and I know you don't believe in hardwiring and things like that, but kind of a predisposition on average in a particular population. Are men evolved to be emotionally more fragile, or is it that in a, you know, in a post-industrial society, they're more fragile?
I would have to go back to some of the data on hunter-gathering societies. I mean, men don't want to show their vulnerability. It's women that do all the complaining, and it's many women who have much more clinical depression than men do. I mean, men, when men are depressed, they drive too fast, they drink too much, they hole up and watch TV, whereas women talk about it to all of their friends and take more drugs. But we found all along, and this year in the Singles in America study, when we asked, are you ready to settle down right now? 42% of men said yes, and 29% of women said yes. So, you know, women are the picky sex. I mean, for millions of years, women not only had to carry that baby for 9 months, but childbirth was dangerous. And women spend much, in every culture in the world, women spend much more time raising tiny babies before the age of 4. So they are the picky sex. And, you know, we, you know,
can I ask before we go off from that point, is that when you say women are the picky sex, I mean, you're essentially, you know, you're arguing that women are the, you know, they control the gate. And how does that fly in the face of a kind of, you know, and I'm thinking of a second wave feminist critique of a lot of evolutionary science, was that, you know, that's just not true, because women were chattel, you know, women were property, women are under a patriarchal structure, you know, where women would just be raped or they would be sold like property. Are you saying that you see even in kind of primitive cultures, or I guess we don't use those words, but hunter-gatherer societies, pre-industrial societies, that women actually exercise a lot of agency in
tremendous agency. Yeah. And I mean, you know,
that's a good thing, right? Or that's a happy story to be telling.
I'm not in a good, bad business, but the bottom line is just looking at the data. You know, I mean, for millions of years, we lived in these little hunting and gathering societies. Women commuted to work to gather their fruits and vegetables. They came home with as much as 60 to 80% of the evening meal. The double income family was the rule. And women were extremely sexually powerful, economically powerful, and socially powerful. It really wasn't until we settled down on the farm that, you know, we evolved all these new beliefs about what a woman is. I mean, on the farm, you know, we see the rise of virginity at marriage for the woman, you know, till death do us part, man's head of the household. Well, that came along with the fact that men's jobs became so much more important. I mean, men now had to, you know, fell the trees, move the rocks, plow the land, took the local produce off to local markets, and came home with the equivalent of money. Women's jobs were to have lots of babies to help on the farm. And you can't leave each other. What are you going to do? Cut the cow in half? You can't do it. You can't move half the wheat field out of town. And so you see around the world in agrarian societies, men's roles becoming much more powerful and women's declining. And
now in a, you know,
this is interesting though. Today, in front of our faces, those belief systems are disappearing. You know, people are always constantly talking about, oh, technology is changing the world. Technology is just enabling us to do the same old thing somewhat faster. But what's the powerful thing is women piling into the job market. We're really moving forward to the kinds of partnerships that we had a million years ago.
That's fascinating. So, I mean, in a weird way, you know, as kind of the industrial era made, you know, is a great leap forward in terms of, like, you know, billions of people could survive now because of things like, you know, industrial agriculture and industrial production of all kinds of goods and services. But that came at a cost of imposing a kind of patriarchal structure. But then you're saying now, like, you know, those structures are fading because our society is organized in a way that women have equal access to education, to work, to status Absolutely. Positions. And that's a reversion back to something, you know, I mean, you almost sound like a Marxist because it's, you know, life before the machines where, you know, people were more egalitarian.
Well, we are certainly seeing a return to the basic things of the hunter-gatherer, yeah. which is highly compatible with our ancient human spirit. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're beginning to, you know, and by the way, I mean, during this pandemic, both men and women now say they want a person who matches them in terms of education, who matches them in terms of making money, and who has a successful career. We have found that men these days really want a woman who want a successful career, not just a job, but a career. I mean, we're moving forward to this double income family that was on this planet for millions of years. Right. And it's great for men as well as women. I mean, men.
Why do you, explain that? Because, you know, and this is, I'm thinking of the, again, you know, growing up, I guess, during the sexual revolution in the 70s, I knew a number of people who were like, you know, men hated women's liberation because they, you know, and on a certain level, they had a terrible deal because men always die younger and they have more heart attacks and there's more violence and things like that. But they got everything. They got, you know, they got to work and the, you know, and then the woman, you know, the wife was there at home with the martinis and the slippers and the folded paper. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly when women started going back to work, men had to, you know, start changing diapers and things like that.
Well, the bottom line is, first of all, I think that's a very glowing look at men. But I mean, for all these years, the whole responsibility of the financial structure of the family was on the man's shoulders. And if he failed, everybody failed. And so I think that men's job for it, people have been fooling themselves that men were on the gravy train. And, you know, when you actually, if somebody dropped in from Mars, they'd say, oh, well, women were on the gravy train. They were sitting at home mixing those martinis while the men were out killing themselves. And not everybody was the CEO. I mean, they were trying to build buildings and subways and the kinds of, I mean, many more men die at work.
So now, you know, I mean, like millennial women, you know, and certainly Gen Z women, they're more likely to go to college, they're more likely to graduate college, they're more likely to have higher paying jobs and things like that. Are we now in a, you know, because you hear this from conservatives a lot that women are, you know, kind of castrating men, that men don't have a clear function anymore in society because they had been the breadwinner, they had been the protector. And now you have women, you know, in an increasing, it's still a small percentage, but an increasing number of women who are like, I don't even need a husband. I don't even need a partner. I'm going to, you know, knock myself up via IVF or something or adopt a kid. And, you know, is that a threat to men or how do you respond to kind of social critics who are like, we are taking away the role of men as a kind of, you know, provider, overlord. And then, you know, part of the deal there is then they have sexual access.
Yeah. Well, I honestly think that this concept of toxic masculinity is a disaster. I mean, men aren't toxic. There's some toxic women around, too. But let me tell you what the real data is. We asked in 1 year in our Singles in America study how men felt about the Me Too movement. And over 50% of them actually liked it. They said it was more comfortable for them. And they've changed their behavior, too. Over 30% are more careful what they put on social media, more careful with what they say in the office, more careful with what they say on a date. And what's interesting is men would really like women to pick up the ball. When I asked the question, you know, I mean, over 90% or depending on over 80%, let's say, of men would be perfectly fine if a woman asked a man for his phone number, who asked him out, who initiated sex with him. Women don't do it. Women want equality in the office. But when it comes to courtship, they want the female role because it's not as risky.
Huh. In one of the sections where you write up the results of singles in America, you talk about them in the manvolution. Yeah. And this is kind of fascinating because we hear a lot about a war on boys, a war on men, you know, and there's, you know, I've talked to a number of people who do therapy work and stuff. There seem to be a lot of lost boys, you know, men who don't quite launch, who, you know, and sexually as well as in other ways. But you talk about the Clooney effect. What is the Clooney effect and why is that
important? It's basically men who want an equal partner. Men who want a woman who is just as smart, just as well educated.
And it's named after George Clooney, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, it wasn't my line, but you know me, I don't know much of this stuff. But the bottom line is, yes, men now want an equal partner, which is once again going back to those hunter-gathering people. You know, I traveled with a hunting-gathering group in Tanzania a few years ago, and I asked a man, you know, whether he wanted to go gathering with women instead of going hunting. He says, sure, I would. I'd always get something to eat. You know, and I said, I asked him, do you want somebody who's a woman who's very effective? He said, yes, I'd go out with a woman who was much smarter than me. She'd make me smart too. That's exactly his line. So, I mean, we've got this Western concept of men and women. They're both wrong. I mean, the fact that the woman wants to stay at home and, you know, continually is wrong. And the fact that, you know, as women's roles have expanded, men's roles have expanded. Women can choose to have the career. Men can begin to choose to stay home and be the parent, the foremost parent.
How does that square then with, you know, rising levels of, you know, anxiety and depression among younger cohorts who are the ones where these sex roles, these gender roles are more fluid? I mean, is there a case to be made? And I hear this sometimes, this is kind of like a Jordan Peterson type line or people like that, where, you know, when all is possible, when there are an infinite number of choices, when the lines of male and female get blurry, people don't know what to do. And that causes depression and anxiety and inaction.
I think it's a really good point. I think we're at this bizarre moment in human history when so many of the roles of both men and women are changing and nobody knows what to do. I mean, I can walk towards a door and I can see a man tense up. Does he open the door for me or does he not open the door for me? There are no rules. And what we're going to do is we're going to build taboos. You know, rules are one thing, taboos are other things. But the thing is, you know, what's important in one relationship is not necessarily important. We don't know how to act. And I think this is one of the reasons that we keep on saying, well, we need clear communication and to understand who you are. It's wonderful. Singles are dedicated to putting themselves together. And I was astonished about a couple of years ago, I asked the question on the Singles in America study, you know, what's keeping you from finding a committed relationship? And 40% said they wanted more self-acceptance. Yeah.
So they were working on themselves before they joined up. Is that a dodge though? I mean, is that, you know, I don't know, you know, like, is that true or do you take that at face value or is it?
Well, when you get such a large population that you begin to believe that there's something there. But I mean, in my generation,
I realize this is a taboo, you know, but the rules don't exist anymore. You are 75 years old, is that correct?
I'm now 76.
76, okay, even better. So you grew up, as did I, in a very different America, right? In a very different world. So,
well, mine was more, I mean, I think we're in a world of the new Victorians now. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, when I hit high school and college, there was no herpes, there was no AIDS.
Right.
You know,
when were you in undergrad?
Well, I got I graduated from boarding school in 63.
Okay.
And I got my PhD in 75.
Okay. So that is pretty much bracketing. That's the shooting war. That's the hot war of in the sexual revolution, right?
I wasn't burning my bra. I mean, but I was doing most of it.
Could you talk a little bit about what's that like? And I want to get to your professional life because you have a really interesting history as an anthropologist, as an academic anthropologist. But, you know, what was it like to be a woman? You're obviously smart and you grew up in a family that did not think, okay, well, you're a girl, so you can be a nurse or, you know, a type, you know, a secretary, but you can't be an accountant or a doctor. What was it like to grow up in that moment where, you know, for the first time in a long time, women were free to kind of pursue what they wanted in a way, you know, it's never perfect, but, you know, just in a radically new way.
Well, it was so natural to me that I didn't know that I was in a fishbowl that, in which things were changing. I mean, my mother always said, you can be anything you want, Helen, which is not true. I'll never be Einstein and I can't sing on tune. So bottom line is there is some genetics to personality. But it was in my house. I mean, I grew up in a glass house. I mean, literally a glass house. On the top of a hill, and I only say that because they were coming out of almost the Victorian era where people were all closed in and all that. And I guess, I don't know whether they, I mean, I sort of assumed that I could do what I wanted to do in life.
That flops over into sexuality though. I mean, because this is, you know, one of the things that so I was born in 1963, and one of the things I remember is studying literature, you know, at the undergrad and graduate level, you know, people in the late 80s were still talking about stuff like the virgin whore complex, which runs through, you know, a lot of literature and certainly, you know, most of the major male writers, but even a lot of the female writers of post-war America were kind of hung up. Like, you know, the two positions for women, you could be, you know, a virgin or a whore or a mother who was a different form of sexlessness. Yeah. And, you know, when you read people like Philip Roth and Norman Mailer and Saul Bellow, you know, the women, as soon as they have sex with somebody, they go from being a beautiful virgin, you know, object of desire to being a whore or worse, a mother. That we don't hear about that anymore.
Well, maybe I grew up in an unusual family. First of all, one of the things my father was, you know, everybody grows up with some mottos. My father's motto was be useful as well as ornamental. Hmm. So I was always expected to make something out of myself. Yeah. That's number one. My father also believed that sexuality, sex was a very important part of a relationship. There was nothing prurient about my father. He never touched my hand or not. He had a tremendous integrity. But he always felt that sex was an important part of a relationship, and it still is.
Do you think America has kind of caught up to him? Because, you know, and I'm thinking again, you know, of, you know, when you look at like the Dick Van Dyke Show or, you know, classic 60s sitcoms and the married couple, I guess this starts with I Love Lucy, you know, where the married couple always has two twin beds, you know, in the bedroom. We don't do that anymore. Are we being more honest as a culture about the way that sexuality sexual desire informs all parts of life?
Yes, I do. I mean, for example, polyamory. I mean, when I did the study with Match, 68% of people think it would be perfectly fine. Only about 6% have ever done it.
Right.
But, we've got the trans and the queer and the this and the that and everything. People are really experimenting with sexuality. As a matter of fact, scientists have long regarded American as a sex negative society, because we've linked it with religion. In Asia, sex is a purely secular experience. It's not linked with religion necessarily. But I think back to your question, which is really an interesting one. Why, here we are in a culture where condoms are always available, people aren't scared of getting pregnant, they're not scared of walking the walk of shame, they're not scared of getting diseases, or at least sex diseases. They know how to handle all this. But yet, there's less and less sex going on. And I do think it's because the rise of all these people dedicated to their career. It's amazing how Americans are so dedicated to their career. You know, I have an identical twin sister, as I mentioned. She lives in France. Apparently in France, you would never say, oh, I worked all weekend. Right. Never.
But the French aren't having more sex than us, right?
I don't know about the French, probably.
And they're heavily sedated too, right? You know,
they're taking lots of.
I mean, that's fascinating to think that work is, you know, and God, this is like a critique of capitalism. I don't know if like from Weber or something, but that, you know, if you're working all the time, you lose interest in sex, or you don't have as much of it.
Well, you don't have enough time for it. I mean, when you got one third of millennials living at home, I mean, you can't be partying in a different boy every night. you know, and if you're working late in the office trying to, you know, your first job as a lawyer and you're there until 2 a.m. Exactly. As a matter of fact, I was once had a discussion with a hooker. I was going to try and study female sexuality from that perspective. And she said, you know, they now get an awful lot of men who give you their home address, you know, because they're single. They don't have time for a relationship. And so they'll go to a, you know, a sex worker because it's safe and it's fast. If they go to a bar, they got to spend hours, you know, trying to pick somebody up. So the bottom line is, I mean, I think America is less sexual, extremely career oriented. The young are maybe in response to the baby boom generation, you know, see the fragility of their parents' relationships and see the competition in their school systems. And there's an awful lot of people who really don't need to go to college to get the job they need. But they're going because that piece of paper gets them a little higher on the totem pole. And so they're
But it comes at the cost of, among other things, their sex life is kind of what you argue. Yeah. Even though college, I mean, God, you know, wasn't that the thing? Maybe that's only makes sense in an America where most people hadn't gone to college, but the whole idea is, you know, college is just like a swinging, it's a panty raid every night, right? You know, it's...
Not anymore.
Yeah.
Now what they're doing is they're not even going on the woodsies or whatever you call them these days. Instead, a group of girls are getting together in the bar, all on their computers, going on to these dating sites, looking for people there. And as they say, and it was a very interesting article about this, they're saying, and these are college people. I mean, you could meet an awful lot of people in college without going on a dating site.
Sure.
But they're going on the dating sites because they get into, why go out and drink 10 beers and have sex with somebody you've never heard of, don't know. Whereas if you go on one of these dating sites, you can read more. And almost 70% of people on these dating sites read the profile. Not, don't just look at the picture. Mm-hmm. Read the profile so that by the time they meet somebody, they already have some idea of who
he is. And you've written elsewhere and talked about this, that it's very common for people to do, you know, everybody checks everybody else on, you know, Facebook and other social media accounts before they meet. But then they often talk via, you know, Zoom or something like that before they meet. So there's an extended vetting process.
Now, this is a really important point. That's another thing that we really saw in this most recent Singles in America study, the rise of video dating. And it's so practical. It will continue because, what, sex is off the table. You don't have to decide whether you're going to kiss them or not. Money's off the table. You don't have to decide whether you're going to meet in a fancy place or not. And what we found is that they're having more meaningful conversations on these video chats. They're speaking for longer. They're doing more self-disclosure, which is men as well as women, more honesty and transparency, more interested in finding whether this person is fully employed and financially stable, and less interested in looks. Yeah. So, I mean, they...
It's because of the bad lighting on Zoom, right? You know, everybody kind of looks like a gargoyle. We're all like, you know, calling from the parapets of Notre Dame Cathedral.
One thing that's interesting, though, is what we found in this year's data is that millennials are 10 times more turned off by a bad background on the video chat. And I think it's for a good Darwinian reason. You know, when you don't know somebody, you're looking for any trait at all. And sure enough, if it is a complete slob hole, or if they're, you know, they're doing it from the back of their truck and there's a gun standing there, or they got 10 cats crawling all over them. I happen to like cats, but 10 I think would be a bit much. So people are going to become more sophisticated at all kinds of internet dating. One of the problems is that there's nothing wrong with the technology. You know what, Nick? These aren't even dating sites. They're introducing sites. That's all they do is introduce you. The same way as a million years ago.
Has Match seen a big uptick? Like our you know, dating, online dating services growing in the numbers of people who are paying for them and things like that.
Oh, yeah. And for obvious reasons. I mean, certainly older people. I mean, I'm too old to stand in a bar and hope somebody like you walks by, you know, it's not going to happen. So, but even the young, it's a practical way of doing things. The problem is that it's so new that people don't know how to do it. And so they binge. And when you binge, you know, I mean, you know, this data that the brain is good at dealing with about 5 to 9 options. After that, it gets swamped. And so these people who keep dating an awful lot of people don't get to know anybody. Match knows that. My guess is all the dating sites know that. So if I had to say one thing to people who are going to go on dating sites, and by the way, it's a very good way to do things for a good reason. But, you know, after you've met 9 people, either through video chatting or in person, stop. If you want to get into a real relationship, stop and get to know somebody better. What's interesting about the future, though, is we ask every year at Match, you know, where did you meet your last first date? And over the last, I would say, 7 out of the 11 years, every single year, more people met their last first date on the internet than off the internet, through a friend, et cetera. And what's interesting about that is I read this study out of the University of Chicago that said people who met on the internet are less likely to divorce. And I thought, well, what difference would it make whether you meet on the internet or in a bar or in a museum? What difference would it make? So I did my own study of that with Match, and I found that people who date on the internet are more likely to be fully employed, to have higher education, and to be interested in a committed relationship. So we're seeing another.
So it's a selection bias, really.
It's a selection bias that is going to lead to more stable marriages. So this slow love, you know, getting to know people longer before you wed and meeting them on the internet, those two huge trends both could lead us into a few decades of relative family stability.
Let's talk about your career. You were trained as an anthropologist, and you know, talk about your early field work, because, and then how do you end up at a place like Match being their chief science advisor? But where did you go to do your, I mean, you were schooled in an age where you did field work, and you, like, you know, Levi Strauss or Margaret Mead or whatever, you got to go out in the world, right? Where did you end up, and what did it teach you?
Well, I first of all, the PhD dissertation was actually a library one, and I was very lucky that they were able to do that. I wanted to know why the human female had lost her period of heat, why she could copulate all month long, and the evolution of why we form partnerships, why we form pair bonds. 97% of mammals do not pair up to where the young people do. It's quite astonishing that we do. And so that led me into understanding the evolution of pair bonding. But I've had two very interesting fieldwork experiences. I lived for 4 months with the Navajo. It was during college, before the PhD. A wonderful professor's husband worked as an anthropologist at the American Museum of Natural History in New York, and he needed somebody to go to a matrilineal culture, a culture where they trace their heritage through women instead of men. So I picked the Navajo, having no clue that it was 7,000 feet high and freezing at February when I showed up. Yes. But I don't know what I learned, except that everybody is the same. Everybody loves. I mean, I was 23 and almost nobody spoke English. I sat for days and days just trying to figure out what's going on around me. I had some real culture shock. You know, his name was Wilbur. He was madly in love with his girlfriend, Allo. And the three of us traipsed around all the time. And you know what? He was just like the people in the New Canaan, Connecticut, where I grew up, the same amount of romance and sensitivity to personal relationships. And then I traveled for only about a week with the Hadza, hunter-gatherers in Tanzania.
Yeah.
And once again, it was so interesting. There was one time I was talking, you know, you had to go from the Hadza language to Swahili to English. So we had a whole pile of interpreters. But I asked this little boy, I don't know what he looked little. He may have been older because, you know, I thought he was around 11. And I said, do you have a girlfriend? And he said, I saw a girl. And I said, oh. And he said, yes, and when I grow up, I'm going to kill a zebra and give her the tail. So I've been to 111 countries in my life, including North Korea and Highlands of New Guinea. Everywhere people love. They sing for love. They dance for love. They have poems about love. They have myths and legends about love. I mean, in a lot of societies, we've got our symphonies and ballets and operas and theater and books and therapists. I mean, the world is deluged by this basic, powerful brain system. So, so interesting how many anthropologists are focused on how we're all different. My lifelong experience is looking how we're all alike.
I know that, you know,
human nature.
Anthropologists are generally not in the business of making normative claims or things like that. But what, you know, if love is a universal, you know, this kind of relationship seeking and pair bonding and things like that, what goes into a society where that is done most, you know, and I'm struggling to, or stumbling over words like the most efficiently and most effectively, but that's not quite getting at them, you know, it, you know, where is there something better about a society where all of the people in the society have the ability to choose, you know, their mates and things like that? And is that a kind of moral value that you would be willing to overlay on this?
Well, it's so interesting because there was a wonderful book, Marriage East and West, and it really explained arranged marriages. In the West, we cannot understand arranged marriages.
Mm-hmm. Although, if I may, just because why not? It's my podcast, but my Italian grandparents who were born in the 1890s in a small village in Italy had an arranged marriage, which they consummated in America. So,
well, you know what? I mean, 10 years in, they're more successful than...
than a Match.com.
Well, because we're marrying later, I think we might be growing up. But the bottom line is, I can't think of any. I mean, I know that the Chinese, when they began to adopt the what they called free love, you know, I mean, free marriage is free. We're overjoyed with it.
Right, and that was a companionate marriage where people were choosing their spouse as opposed to.
But what's interesting is around the world today, even there's no place in the world where marriages are arranged between two people who have never met each other. Mm-hmm. Everywhere in the world now, they meet several times. Before they decide what they're going to talk, I mean, wed, and they can make decisions. I mean, I've seen this in Saudi Arabia. Actually, I talked to women in Saudi Arabia, but they often will say to you, you know, they like the arranged marriage because they say, oh, you Westerners, you girls get all dressed up like sluts and talk with all these boys. Well, why? We just stay with our friends and our parents introduce us to the right kind of people. So, you know, they don't feel terribly trod upon by doing this. They can make the choices themselves. And a lot of arranged marriages are extremely successful.
With slow love, is slow love, you know, this kind of extended courtship and extended move into a fully committed relationship, which then also lasts long, because I know in you have data at various places, including in an essay about slow love, that, you know, people 30, 40 years into a marriage report incredibly high rates of still being in love with the person.
Absolutely.
Is that mostly a function of things like us living longer and, you know, we can take things slower because we're not going to die at 45?
I think it's largely because of this long courtship period in which you find out much more. So I don't think it's the aging process as much as it is the fact that the young are spending much more time trying to find the right one and being rather picky about it and marrying much later. I mean, you know, parents are no longer pressuring their children to marry. In the old days, if you were 23 and you weren't married, your parents were pressuring you. Now, when a 23-year-old wants to marry, their parents are going to say, it's too early.
Right.
And so I do think it's this very long courtship period. But what's interesting, but you know, I put people in brain scanners and study romantic love. And one of our studies with people who are in love long term, they kept on coming into the lab saying, I'm still in love with her. I'm still in love with them after not just loving, but in love. Mm-hmm. And
what does that mean? What's the difference between loving somebody and being in love?
Being in love is the dopamine system in the brain. This is when you obsess.
You're seeing stars and things like that.
You're focused. You're highly motivated. You laugh at all their jokes. You positive illusions. You overlook what you don't like. You're dying to get home at night. You're not talking about divorce. You continue to respect them and trust and confide in them. And you know, whereas the just loving somebody is probably a form of what I call attachment, which is a different brain system run by the oxytocin system, in which, yes, you definitely like your partner, you love your partner, but you don't, you're not craving your partner anymore, you know. But, you know, basically what we want in a long-term partnership is all three brain systems, the sex drive, testosterone, feelings of intense romantic love, at least now and then, the dopamine system, and the third brain system of attachment. But anyway, we put these people who were said they were in love, not just loving, but in love, long-term, into the brain scanner. Sure enough, we found activity in all the basic brain regions linked with not only romantic love, but also brain regions linked with attachment and brain regions linked with the sex drive. But then we looked at those people who scored very high in a happiness scale that you give them a lot of questionnaires before you put them in the machine. These are the three people always say, well, what makes a happy partnership? Psychologists, all good. There's lots of reasons that psychologists would say. This is what the brain says. The three brain regions that become active in a long-term, happy, in-love partnership. Brain region linked with empathy, brain region linked with controlling your own stress and your own emotions, and a brain region linked with what we call positive illusions, the ability to overlook what you don't like about somebody and focus on what you do.
Wow. Would you say, you know, overall, like as men and women become more equal in American culture, that we're better off?
Yes.
Yeah. And how do we measure that though? Because again, so, you know, we're not having as much sex, but the relationships we're forming are better, or how do you quantify? I mean, it's very positive, you know, to think that like people are better off now because we are able to have more agency in our lives, particularly in our intimate lives. But then, you know, we're having less sex. There's high rates of depression and anxiety.
Well, you know, first of all, I'm not in the good bad business, as you know. But just going back to the hunter gatherers, I mean, for millions of years, we lived in groups where men married interesting women who brought a great deal, not only economically and socially, but sexually to the relationship. And we now have a society in which we can do that again. Women aren't stuck in the home. Men aren't stuck with being the sole responsibility for the good economic health of the family. We live in a world now where you can really be who you want to be. You can jump class, get yourself an education, move into the job market at a different level. I mean, this is all good. We're living longer. It's a more exciting time than any time on the planet. It's amazing how many young don't want to have children, because here we are at a time when we're healthier, we're better educated, we've got more opportunities. We can have many more experiences. We're not stuck in one tiny little farm village where everybody's going to criticize us if we don't know how to dance or whatever. It's a wonderful time to be alive. And I just want to say one other thing here. You know, you were asking about, there's many reasons that we fall for one person rather than another, all kinds of cultural reasons. We tend to fall in love with somebody from the same socioeconomic background, same level of education, same degree of intelligence and good looks, with the same social values and economic goals, et cetera. But, you know, I've also studied personality, and I've found various patterns, styles of thinking and behaving. And we're now at a time when we can begin to understand who other people are at a very much more sophisticated level. I really think that it's going to become maybe easier and easier to find what we're looking for.
You know, final question to Helen Fisher, who's the chief science consultant or science advisor for Match.com and is a senior research fellow at the Kinsey Institute and the writer of many books. This struck me in your work in Singles in America. You found this seems like the ultimate sign of parity between men and women, that nearly half of both genders faked an orgasm this past year, 47% of men and 46% of women. What's going on? Not that they're faking it, but it's like, okay, this is like, there's an old Seinfeld line where Kramer, after Elaine, you know, it tells Jerry that she faked a lot of orgasms with him. Kramer's like, oh yeah, I faked mine too. But, I mean, how do you know, where was that number 10 years ago?
Well, I don't know about 10 years ago because we didn't ask, but I guess that this is basic to the human animal, and that 10 years ago it may have been exactly the same. But you, first of all, Nick, you're the only person that's asked this. I thought that was the most fascinating part of this entire thing. And we did ask, not this year, but another year, why? Why do you fake an orgasm? And I think the answer is pretty obvious. First of all, they get too tired.
They're too tired. Yeah, it's enough already. Yeah.
Or they want to please their partner and they don't want to go on forever, you know. Those are the two basic reasons. I mean, it's all part of the mating strategy. You know, either a good way to get out of something, you know, or a good way to impress and get farther into the relationship. But what is astonishing, I mean, what's amazing about it is, you know, your mother doesn't teach you to fake orgasms. They'll teach you a lot.
My mother certainly didn't.
Yeah. No, mine didn't either. It's something that we seem to do naturally. So I don't think that this is just modern America. I mean, this is something that I've never heard of anybody being taught. Okay, you want to get out of it, fake an orgasm. Okay, you want to please fake an orgasm. I think it's human. I bet they were doing that a million years ago.
That's amazing. So the study is Singles in America, and there's a website, Singles in America, is that .com?
I guess, yeah, singlesinamerica.com.
Yeah, where you can read about the latest 11th survey that matched us of 5,000 representative people, all ages, all colors, all genders, all orientations. And we've been talking with Dr. Helen Fisher, Chief Science Advisor to Match. Helen, thanks so much for taking the time.
I'm delighted, Nick. Absolutely. Thank you.
This has been The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts. It's out there. Or make it easy on yourself and just go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there. Thanks for listening.